Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce today, speaking on elections and governing in an age of political polarization, Henry E. Brady, the Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and the Monroe Deutsch Professor of Public Policy at that school. For those of you who aren't familiar, Monroe Deutsch was one of the presidents of the Commonwealth Club in the 1940s. Dean Brady.
It's not clear to me that a discussion of politics should be in the humanities form, perhaps the comedy form, perhaps the military or war form, but not the humanities form. But nevertheless, we'll try to see what we can do. I'm going to have some artwork in here, so maybe it does belong, and that's in some of the slides I'm going to show. I'm going to try to explain the slides, so if anybody is only hearing the audio, they'll understand what we're doing here. What I want to do today is four things. I want to talk about how to predict a presidential election and the ways that political scientists try to do that. I'm going to talk about polarization in American politics, because this has really shaped the campaign that we've just seen and is going to definitely shape the public policies or lack thereof that we're going to see after the election. I'm specifically going to talk about a big set of public policy issues surrounding what's called the fiscal cliff, which occurs at the beginning of next year when we face a whole lot of legislation that has to be dealt with that will end tax cuts, increase taxes, cut expenditures, and require the reappropriation of some past expenditures if they're going to continue. And so that'll have an enormous impact on the economy if none of that gets done. And then I just can't forbear, I'm going to talk a little bit about Proposition 30 in California, partly because it tells us that the questions I'm talking about with respect to the nation, polarization, and the fractious nature of our politics are reproduced here in California, and Prop 30 is right at the center of that. So, how to predict a presidential election. For those of you who buy stocks and engage in stock trading, you've probably heard about the difference between the fundamentals as one way to understand how to buy stock versus technical analysis. Well, in fact, we have a similar thing in political science. One way to try to understand who's going to win an election is look at the fundamentals of the economy and society and ask how those fundamentals allow you to predict who's going to win the election. So that's basic stuff like the economy and incumbency and so forth. But there's also another way, which is technical analysis of polls. Just look at the daily polls, try to analyze them, look at their trends, and see where they're leading us. So I'm going to do both of those methods. There's a third method. You can analyze candidates' strengths and weaknesses, and you hear that ad infinitum out there. As people talk about, Obama has the advantage of incumbency, but obviously the disadvantage that the economy is just simply terrible. Although the growth rate today of 2% is a good thing for Obama. Next week we hear the jobs numbers coming out, and we'll see what they look like. He's had a mixed kind of record with respect to the jobs numbers in the last 3 or 4 months, but basically they've been sort of positive, and certainly the unemployment rate getting down to 7.8% was good for him. So I'm going to talk about these first two to begin with. Fundamentals. What political scientists do is they collect data on a whole lot of economic indicators. They use incumbency because incumbency gives somebody an advantage. So Obama does have an advantage because he's an incumbent. That's different than the situation we had in 2008 when there was no incumbent. There was an incumbent party, but not an incumbent candidate. War matters. So political scientists measure things like U.S. military fatalities. The more fatalities, typically the less popular an incumbent is. And then there's also questions of candidate strength and presidential approval, what's called the trial heats, which is Romney versus Obama kinds of questions, or candidate popularity. Approve of this candidate and do you like this candidate? Those kinds of things matter. So all the models I'm about to talk about use these kinds of variables. They look at the past, they see how they've helped predict who won the election, and then they use that information about where we are right now to see if they can predict the current election. So, in a publication called PS, Political Science and Politics, put out by the American Political Science Association, 10 models were put forth by various political scientists. That's just about a month ago. What these do is they look at Obama's share of the two-party vote. You could look at Romney's share, but since Obama's the incumbent, it's sort of natural to focus on that. But it really doesn't matter, because what you're asking is Obama going to get over 50% of the two-party vote, in which case probably he's going to win in the Electoral College, although we'll talk about that in a minute and the complexities of that, or is he going to get less than 50%, in which case he's probably going to lose? Well, in these 10 national models by different authors, using different techniques, using different data, the range was, so political scientists help us understand the world, they tell us either Obama's going to win or he's going to lose. So the range is from 47.5% for Obama, he's going to lose, to 53.8%, he's going to win. That's a pretty big range. In six of the models, Obama wins. In four, Romney wins. When you look at these data and do what a statistical method called a meta-analysis, you find out that there's a 60% chance from these models that Obama's going to win. And that's, I think, about right, given what I thought. I remember about 6 months ago somebody asked me, I said, I think there's a 55% chance Obama will win. I think it's 60% right now because, in fact, people blame George W. Bush still for a lot of the troubles that Obama had to deal with. That's something that has helped Barack Obama, that they continue to blame George W. Bush. Now, there's another way to do this, is to actually look state by state and look at how the vote will turn out. So use the same kind of variables, but measure them for each state, and then look at how each state's going to come out. And there's three papers that looked at that, and they ranged in the two-party vote for Obama from 47.1%, Obama will lose, to 51.6%, Obama will win. Two models, Obama wins, and one, Romney wins. So that's 67% chance that Obama will win. Again, same kind of result. So that's the fundamentals. There's also a technical analysis of polls that can be done. Here you just take the polls that have been done and you essentially average them. You can get sophisticated in how you average them because some polls are better than others. Some they have bigger number of respondents, or you just know technically they're better. Some polling firms have biases that are pretty well known. They're more Republican or they're more Democratic. You might want to adjust for that. But whatever you do, you basically average these things. National polls on a website called Real Clear Politics, which is a very good website worth looking at, right now, today, has Romney up by 1 percentage point, 0.9 percentage point to be exact. Romney has 47.9 and Obama 47%. So that says Romney would win the popular vote. Obama was at 49.1% and Romney at 46%, so a 3.1 percentage point difference on October 2nd, 2012. And of course, I picked that date because that was the date just before the what? The debate, the first debate. And it's clear that Obama took a beating after that debate. Now, I wasn't actually so surprised at what happened after the debate. I think it was really surprising that Obama was leading by so much at that point, given the economic conditions in this country. And I think what we really have is one of those chemistry experiments where the teacher puts in various fluids and stuff and nothing happens. And then the teacher just takes something and taps the side of the container ever so slightly and all sorts of stuff starts happening. It catalyzes the reaction. That debate catalyzed a reaction that was not a surprise to me because I thought a lot of those people who were not saying they were going to vote for Romney probably had the predilection to do so. They were identifiers with the Republican Party. They thought the economy was bad. They weren't that happy with Obama. They just didn't yet see that Romney was a legitimate choice. And so in that debate, they suddenly said, oh my gosh, Romney looks like a legitimate choice. And so therefore, I'm going to go back home, really where I belong, and say I'm going to vote Republican. So now the question, of course, is whether Obama might have been lucky and nobody would have tapped that container, and therefore he could have kept his lead if he could somehow have done better in that first debate and continued to have done so. But my guess is something would have come along and shown that Romney was a legitimate alternative. He's not quite as bad as some of the ads the Democrats had been putting out there suggested. Okay, so that's the national vote with the polls. But another way to look at things is take state polls and look at the Electoral College, because after all, as we all know, the Electoral College actually finally decides the election. Currently, Obama, according to Real Clear Politics, has 201 safe electoral votes. What they're doing is they're looking at various states, and they're saying, how much of a lead does Obama have, or how much of a lead does Romney have? So, for example, in California, Obama has a big lead. Everybody thinks California's electoral votes will go to Obama, so everybody puts that in the Obama column. In Texas, it's the reverse. So Texas goes in the Romney column. So there's 201 electoral votes for Obama, 191 for Romney. You need 270 to win, and there's 146 toss-up states, according to Real Clear Politics. The next slide here gives you what those states are. And notice there's about 11 of them. I'll read them quickly. There's in the West, Colorado and Nevada. In the South, there's Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia. In the Midwest, there's Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. And then in the Northeast, we have New Hampshire and Pennsylvania. What I've also done on this slide is I've shown you some information about other sources of information, whether they think these are toss-up states. So I've gone and looked at the Stuart Rothenberg political report. He's a really good analyst, has very careful in what he does, and Charlie Cook's political report. These are two guys who are really thoughtful about politics, and I've seen whether they thought these were toss-up states as well. They're more conservative than Real Clear Politics, and indeed, when I first looked at the Real Clear Politics list, I said, Michigan? Nah, that's going for Obama. North Carolina? Nah, that's going for Romney. And Pennsylvania? That's going for Obama. So I never really thought those are big toss-up states. And indeed, what I give you here for those three states is the margin that the leading candidate currently has over the other candidates. So Obama has a 4-point lead in Michigan, 5-point lead for Obama in Pennsylvania, and 5-point lead for Romney in North Carolina. So let's get rid of those three states. I don't think they're really going to be in play. And let's look at the rest of the states we've got here. Okay. These are the current average poll results for these various states and who's ahead. So Romney, for example, is about 0.4 percentage points, essentially nothing, ahead of Obama in Colorado. In Florida, Romney's 1.7 percentage points ahead. In Virginia, he's 1.5 percentage points ahead. And then Obama's ahead in all of the other states, Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Wisconsin. So let's just use those data and count up electoral votes. And you end up with Obama with 281 and Romney 257. Charlie Cook thinks Obama's further ahead. Stuart Rothenberg thinks he's less far ahead. I think it's 277 he gives to Obama right now. But notice this is a very, very close election because, in fact, if Ohio goes to Romney, given this calculation, and everything else stays the same, then Romney wins. Wisconsin, Obama still wins, but he has 271 electoral votes, one more than he needs. It's really, really close. So it's clear that Ohio and Wisconsin really matter. It's also clear that Romney has to get Florida. Absolutely has to get Florida. If he doesn't get Florida, he's going to be in deep trouble. So one of the things you can do on election night is look at Florida. If Florida is looking like it's going to Obama, then Obama is in very, very good shape. If Florida is going to Romney, that's good for Romney, but he's still got a bunch of other steps he's got to take. It's been true throughout this election period that Romney had the harder path to the presidency through the Electoral College than Obama. And that's what this calculation basically tells you. So let me just say something, and I've just stolen this from Charlie Cook's website, but I think it's pretty much what most people think right now. The Senate, I think, is probably going to be Democratic, 52 Democrats, 46 Republicans, two independents, Maine and Vermont. That means the Senate will be up one Democrat and down one Republican from where it currently is. It might be a little different than that, but probably the Democrats will retain the Senate, although that's not absolutely clear. There's more seats that are Democratic, currently Democratic seats that are being contested right now than seats that are currently Republican. So, in fact, the Democrats are vulnerable in terms of all the seats that are up. but it's looking like it's shaking out to the Democrats maintaining the Senate, and it doesn't help the Republicans when they have flare-ups like they've just recently had in Indiana with the unfortunate comments about rape by one of their candidates. So that really is the kind of thing that hurts, because Indiana should go Republican, but now it's looking more dicey with Richard Murdoch's comment about rape. That's the one that God intended for the rape to occur, at least as some people interpret it. So it's an unfortunate comment, to say the least. The House will stay Republican, probably 240 Republicans and 195 Democrats. Conclusion, Obama barely winning as president and a divided Congress, most likely with a Democratic Senate and a Republican House. Okay, why is this happening? What's happened in America that makes for these closely divided elections and for a politics that's so vitriolic as it's become? Well, the answer is we've got polarization in America. And this picture is my representation of that. This is a Calder gouache, Alexander Calder, very famous artist. And I've actually twisted and turned it using a computer program I found on the web. So it's sort of reflected in backwards. So the Calder signature can't be quite easily read. But I did that for a purpose. Think of this picture as being on the horizontal axis, people's positions on economic issues, left to right. And the vertical axis, people's positions on social issues. These are the two major issues of American politics right now, economics and social issues, by which I mean abortion, gay rights, things like that. And so assume the vertical axis is liberals down towards the bottom, conservatives towards the top. So if you just sort of have people stand where they belong on this picture, all the liberals are going to congregate in the lower left-hand corner. Because they're liberal on economic issues, they're liberal on social issues. And that's that big blue circle there that's filled in. All the conservatives will end up in the upper right-hand corner. They're conservative on economic issues, they're conservative on social issues. And as you notice in this picture, between these two blobs, a good description of parties, between these two blobs, the blue, because what's the color coding that the networks use for the parties? Democrats are blue, Republicans are red. That was casting against type because, as we all know, actually Democrats are on the left, so they probably should be red because that would represent reds. But then actually the networks purposely decided not to do that because they felt that it would be making an editorial comment. So they decided to make the Republicans the reds. I actually have some colleagues who, when they do these kinds of things, they adamantly refuse to make the Democrats blue. They make the Democrats red on the grounds that's the proper color scheme. What you notice between these two blobs in this figure is this wall between them, this very strong line. That's the kind of polarization we have in America. The two parties don't overlap in this picture. There's a wall, there's a solid black line down the middle of this picture, and I think this is a great representation of polarization in America. So you may see art, and I love this picture, I think it's a beautiful picture. What I see is politics. So every place I look, I see politics. Okay. And by the way, I don't know what some of these other little pieces of the picture are, and I'll leave that to your interpretations, you can have fun with it. Metaphors can only be pushed so far. So this is the humanities part of the presentation, by the way. Okay, the next thing, I'm actually going to go to the next slide, but what this is an attempt to try to understand the makeup of the parties in terms of socioeconomic characteristics. And what I've done here is I've taken a survey of the American public from 2008, actually, and this asks about their income and their education and also their party identification. Are they Democrats, Republicans, or independents? And then what I do is I put them into five bins. People with low education and low income, people with high education and high income at the other end, and in between people with mixed characteristics. But basically a continuum from low income, low education on the left to high income, high education on the right. And then I've asked for each bin, each group there, what's the percentage in that bin who are Democrats or Republicans? And what you see here is that there's a lot of Democrats at the lower SES levels and very few Republicans, and it's the reverse at the other side, although you might notice that still at the even at the upper end of the SES spectrum, there's actually a higher percentage Democrats than Republicans. That's for two reasons. Number one, there's actually more Democrats in the population than Republicans, so that just pushes that curve upwards. The second reason is the Democrats are a more heterogeneous party than the Republicans. On this picture, the Republican line is much more highly skewed upward. It's much steeper. And in fact, another way to say this is to look at this slide where I say, for the Democrats, there's 47% of Democrats come from the bottom two quintiles. Now, you'd expect, since they're quintiles, they're 20% of the population, you'd expect 40% of the population if it were just evenly taken from each quintile. But it's 47% of the Democrats, so the Democrats are more highly represented at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum than they are at the upper end of the spectrum, where there's only 35% of them. Again, you'd expect 40% if it was just a random selection. But notice, Republicans are even more skewed. There's 51% of the Republicans come from the top two quintiles. A majority of Republicans come from the top two quintiles of the socioeconomic distribution. It's even steeper, by the way, if you just use income and not education. And only about a quarter come from the bottom two quintiles. So the Republicans are a more homogeneous party. They're concentrated at the upper SES levels, higher income, higher education. What does that mean? That means the Republicans have an easier time on focusing on a policy that's important to those upper income groups. So like, don't cut the taxes of high income people. Republicans can easily talk about that because that appeals to the base of the party. Democrats have a harder time talking about taxing the rich because the truth is there's a fair number of well-off people in the Democratic Party who are not so thrilled with the notion of being taxed. So Democrats more heterogeneous, Republicans more homogeneous. Let's go back to this idea I mentioned a moment ago of two basic dimensions of American politics. And let's explore this a little bit, because what I want to talk about is how, in the last 30 years, the parties have become more polarized along these dimensions. They have moved further apart. They used to be fairly close to one another on these dimensions, so not that much different. It used to be the case there were moderate and even liberal Republicans. Think of a Jacob Javits or a Nelson Rockefeller. It used to be the case there were conservative Democrats. Think of all the Southern Democrats. Strom Thurmond, even at one time, was a Democrat, and people like that. But now the parties have sorted, and there's a lot more purity in each party. Each party has got a particular distinctive ideological flavor. The Republicans are conservative, the Democrats are liberal. And I want to look at two different sets of issues and liberal-conservative positions on them. Income and economic issues. So the parties, I just showed you that the parties are different in terms of income. I'm going to now show you something about economic issues and their beliefs about them. And then I'm just going to say a word or two about religious attendance. The parties are really different in that regard. A lot more Republicans go to church than Democrats. And that leads to different views on social moral issues like gay marriage, abortion, and so forth. I'm going to say a word or two about how that's really become a new dimension of American politics in the last 30 or 40 years. So the next slide is my Jackson Pollock period. There's a lot of color on the canvas here. And let me describe what's going on here. This is a picture of what's happened over time along the horizontal axis. And what it does is, on the vertical axis, people towards the bottom are liberal positions, people at the top are conservative positions. And what it does is it plots for various groups how those positions on average have changed over time. So the red line here, for example, is the positions of people who say they're Republicans. And what you notice is over time, they've gotten much more conservative. They've moved up in this diagram. On the other hand, the Democrats have moved down in the diagram towards the more liberal positions. And the important thing to note is we've gone from a situation where there was that much separation on the left, with that bar that I've just put up on the diagram, to a lot more separation on the right. There's a lot bigger ideological difference now between the parties than there was in 1972. And this only goes to 2004, but trust me, if you extend it out to today, it'll have the same form. I was looking at some data recently that actually make me think it's really become even more extreme. These other lines on the diagram are actually for activists in the parties, people who give money and people who give time to political campaigns. They're people who are more intense about politics, more knowledgeable about politics. And what's interesting there is we get this kind of split over time. Activists have gone from being, yes, separate, different between the two parties, but being a lot different now. So, by the way, I was trying to illustrate these diagrams when I was at the University of Florida, and basically they look like an alligator's jaws opening up. And I was doing this on the podium, and the crowd went wild. And I thought, my gosh, I'm having a big impact on these people. And then somebody noted that, of course, the University of Florida's mascot is the Gators. So I was making the Gator sign, which is to open your arms like that, split them apart. So anyways, unexpected things happen as you travel around the country. This one I'm going to do very quickly, and there's a lot of more explanation that's necessary. But really what you need to see is social moral positions over time, you get the same kind of split over time, and especially among activists. So what's happened is we've got a lot more division between the two parties on the liberal conservative dimension. And you know what I mean by that in terms of scoring these. Obviously, a liberal position is that you're pro-choice on abortion, you're pro-gay marriage. A conservative position would be the opposite. On the economic issues, it's how do you feel about taxes and spending? So those are the kinds of issues that are in the measures we use on these diagrams. And we find, using all sorts of different measures, that the parties have simply spread apart and sorted themselves out into liberal and conservative positions big time. Okay, and let me just show you one more picture, which has got a lot on it, but I just want to give you a stylized sense. This is that two-dimensional picture, like the Calder picture I showed you before. Notice the blue circles in the lower left-hand corner, like the blue blob we had in the Calder picture. In the upper right-hand corner, the Republicans. And what I've put on this is, using a 2008 survey, various measures of where people stood on two kinds of issues. Along the bottom, economic issue again. This is actually a question about should there be redistribution of income, where the obvious position for liberals on the left is yes, there should be, and the obvious position for conservatives on the right is no, there shouldn't be. And then social issues, which is an amalgam of questions about abortion, about gay marriage, and so forth. And so what we find is, not surprisingly, the Democrats are in the lower left-hand corner, the Republicans are in the upper right-hand corner, but the most remarkable thing about this diagram, and something we see reproduced with lots of other data, is that the Republicans are further from the average citizen. At the middle of the diagram, I've got citizens, where they stand, where the average American is on the poll. Republicans are much further away than Democrats are. And this has been one of the findings that's come out in the last few years. And for a long time, many of us saw it in the data, but we just really didn't have the gumption to say it because we were trying to be even-handed. And we knew that part of what was going on was that both parties were becoming more extreme. But it's now become clear that the Republicans have become more extreme than the Democrats have become. And indeed, my colleagues, Norm Orenstein, who's at the American Economic Institute, which is American Enterprise Institute, pardon me, the AEI, and Tom Mann, who's at Brookings. Brookings is thought of as a liberal institution. American Enterprise Institute is thought of as a conservative institution. They wrote a book together, and they basically say in the book, it's the Republicans that have moved the furthest away from the center. And that was hard for Norm Orenstein, being at the American Enterprise Institute, and needless to say, he's gotten a lot of flack for it, but I think the data support what he says. That's what's happened in America, that the Republicans have become more extreme than the Democrats have become extreme. That's not to say the Democrats aren't bad actors a lot and aren't sometimes quite extreme on issues. They certainly are. But the Republicans have become quite extreme. So the mass public is polarized along two dimensions. The polarization between the two parties has increased dramatically since 1972, and polarization is greater among activists than among the mass public. This next diagram that I'm showing you is, and I'm not going to go into a lot of details about what's here, but basically this sort of says on a liberal conservative dimension, if we look at members of Congress, where do they stand? And how do the two parties differ within the two houses. And what this shows is that Democrats are on the left, Republicans are on the right. That's not a surprise. What's a surprise is how there's no overlap in these curves. The most extremely liberal Republican is to the right, more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. So there's no overlap between the two parties. There used to be. And the next picture just shows you what it was like in 67, 68, when in fact, as you'll notice, there's a lot of overlap between the two parties. There were the Jacob Javits. There were the Southern senators. So the parties, when they got together, were heterogeneous, not homogeneous. And therefore, they had to think about building coalitions of various and sundry ideological perspectives because they had ideological diversity within their own party. Okay. And the next slide just shows you that polarization has increased over time, where this is basically a measure of how far apart are the two parties. And they've gotten further and further apart in both the House and the Senate. Okay. Why is that so? This picture shows you what's happened with respect to the filibuster, and whether this is a cause or a consequence is not clear, but it's certainly the case that in the 60s, the filibuster was hardly used, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times a session. Now it's used, and it depends on what you're looking at, whether you're looking at cloture motions, which are in the first step to try to get rid of a filibuster and an indicator that somebody's trying to stop a filibuster, or if there's a vote on cloture, that's the next step. You actually get a vote. And the third step is cloture is invoked, which means that somebody gets enough votes to stop the filibuster. Those are three different measures of how much filibustering is going on. But all three go up over time, and they go up almost exponentially. So we've gone up from just a few filibusters to now in the range, depending upon what measure you use, of about 100. So clearly there's a lot of more division within the Senate of the United States than there used to be 30, 40 years ago. And this, of course, tracks the data I showed you before. So one reason it suggests is going on is somehow out there politicians have sorted it into the two parties, are much more polarized on issues, and therefore when you get to the floor of the Senate, a filibuster occurs by one side or another to try to stop what's going on. Okay, so elites. So I showed you before that the mass public is polarized. Now I've just shown you elites, that is to say members of Congress, are polarized, and it's increased over time. And Republicans have moved further to the right than Democrats have to the left. So the result I showed you with the mass public is also true with elites. Okay, what does this mean? It means we're in trouble. It means when we get to something like the fiscal cliff, we got problems. The fiscal cliff is a term used to describe a set of tax cuts that will expire, tax increases that will occur, expenditure cuts that will automatically occur, and expenditures that will need to be reauthorized if they're going to happen again, or reappropriated, actually, is the technical term. If we make all of the tax increases, because a tax cut expiring is a tax increase, and a tax increase obviously, there's a tax increase. Expenditures being cut means we're spending out less. What this does is takes an enormous amount of stimulus out of the economy. We're going to be taxing people more heavily. They will spend less. We are going to be spending less as a government. Therefore, there'll be less money to be spent. As a result, if these things happen, we have, as I show in the next chart, and the really important figure is the lower right-hand corner, the in bold, $680 billion in destimulation of the economy. Now, you might remember the stimulus was about $800 billion. And by the way, if you think the stimulus had no impact whatsoever, you don't have to worry about the fiscal cliff. It won't have an impact. So to be consistent, you have to either believe the stimulus worked and the fiscal cliff is a problem, or you have to believe the stimulus didn't work and the fiscal cliff isn't a problem. By the way, that kind of consistency isn't found out there among most politicians. So most politicians, actually of the left and the right, think that the fiscal cliff is a problem. Democrats, for obvious reasons, because they happen to think this kind of stuff matters. Republicans, because they don't want to end the tax cuts. So What this does is gives you a balance sheet of all the different programs, and I'm not going to go through all of them, except to note $680 billion. By the way, one reason the fiscal cliff will have a big impact is it's actually not just a one-time $680 billion destimulation of the economy. It's a repeated destimulation year after year. So it's as if you had destimulation programs this year, next year, on and on and on. So that's going to have a big impact. What are the estimates? Goldman Sachs, Moody's Analytics, the Congressional Budget Office think that if all these things occur, tax cuts expire, tax increases occur, expenditures are cut, and this kind of destimulation occurs, we will have a decline in productivity of GDP of about 4%. That's a recession. It's a really significant recession. So that's the bad news. Let me tell you the good news. The good news is if we do these things, since we're going to have more tax revenue coming in and less spending, we're actually going to help solve our budget deficit problem. So one way to do that is to really seriously destimulate the economy. These are the austerity kinds of programs that have been used in Europe that have had some impact on helping with the budget problems they have there. Although the bad thing that happens is by destimulating the economy, you send it into a downward spiral of people losing jobs, and then there's fewer people to tax because there's fewer people working. So the needle's eye that has to be gone through here is you want to stimulate the economy, but you want to solve these long-term budget deficit problems. And that's a tough one. But one answer is to do something short-term to maintain the stimulus, but then at the same time have a deal where you would promise that you're actually going to try to deal with the longer-term problems. Likely results of an election, and what does this mean for the fiscal cliff? Well, I've already indicated that I think Obama is more than likely to be president, although I wouldn't put high confidence on it, 60, 65%. Likely the Senate will be Democratic and the House Republican. That's one picture of what the future looks like. The other picture is that Romney will be president. Then I think the Senate might likely go Republican because in his coattails he will bring along some of those Senate races. And the House will be Republican. I'm pretty sure the House is going to be Republican no matter what. And I put about a 20% probability on that. About a 15% probability that Romney will be president, but the Senate Democratic. And then Obama president and the Senate Republican. I actually am not even sure that 4% is not too high. And then the other outcomes with House Democratic, less than 1%. I really can't imagine that occurring. But the top two ones are very interesting ones. One is Obama president, Senate Democratic, House Republican. The other is Romney president, Senate Republican, and House Republican. Notice that's unified control of all three of the essential institutions for getting legislation passed. What does it mean? If you have the first scenario, Obama wins, Senate is a Democratic, the House is Republican, I think you're going to get gridlock, but there's room for a deal. I would think you're going to get some Simpson-Bowles kind of deal from the president. I actually honestly do believe that he cares about that, wants to do something about it. I think you're also going to find that you get the Republicans agreeing that maybe they would forego the Bush tax cuts for the upper income groups. And so there's room for bargaining along those lines. On the other hand, if Romney wins, the Senate becomes Republican, and the House is Republican, then except for the filibuster, the Republicans will have a very open field. And I suspect they will use reconciliation, which is this mechanism whereby you only need 51 votes, which is what was used ultimately for the Obama health care bill, by the way, that they will use that and use it again and again and again, and they'll make major cuts in programs. They'll do Ryan-esque kinds of cuts of entitlement programs, and they will really go to town in terms of trying to really deal with the deficit problem, and in the process, destimulate the economy. Okay. Let me just say one word about Proposition 30. And all I want to show you is this graph here, which shows you that general fund expenditures in California as a percentage of state gross domestic product have gone down recently substantially. That is to say, if you take the total amount of goods and services we produce in this state, the total amount going to government has gone down. And that's because there's been massive cuts in spending in Sacramento. Most people don't believe this. I took these data from the Legislative Analyst's Office website, and I plot them for you. That's all I'm doing. Roughly, there's been something like $25 to $30 billion in cuts, so that we're now down to a general fund budget of about $90 billion. And one reason I know this is occurring is because I know what's happened to higher education in this state. And this is over time plot and shows you that higher education has just gotten slaughtered in the last 20 or 30 years. It's gone down. Criminal justice and corrections has gone up. K through 12 is stayed at about 40% of the total budget. By the way, the total budget, as I say, has been cut. So this 40% is actually less now than it was a few years ago because the total budget has shrunk. But this just shows you the proportions of where it's going. And let me just show you what this means for higher education in California. At the UC campuses, 10 years ago, we got $23,670 per pupil to do our teaching function. This is in real dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars. We now get $10,300. If Prop 30 fails, we'll have another $1,250 cut for each pupil at the University of California. The same thing's happened with the CSUs as well. There have been devastating, draconian cuts to the UC, CSU, and even the community colleges, although on this scale it's not so obvious. What does that mean? I think that means that in the long run, the state of California will be ill-served because you will have a less well-educated population. That population will pay less in taxes, will need more public services, will be more likely to go to jail, and therefore, in the short run, it'll look like you're saving money, but in the long run, you're going to have a ticking time bomb of a less prosperous state, which requires more public services and has less capacity to pay taxes. Now, that's obviously, I'm an academic. I think higher education is a worthwhile investment. Therefore, from my perspective, if Prop 30 passes, that would be very helpful to the state of California. I'm not allowed to say how you should vote on this, but you may be able to imagine how I feel about the proposition. But this is another indication of the kind of gridlock we have in California and in the United States. So conclusions. American politics is closely divided. Polarization, which is actually sorting of people, is real. And the election, including Prop 30 in California, has significant implications for the future of America. Thanks.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Henry Brady speaking about the upcoming election and political prognosis for it. First question.
Having given this a lot, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Having given this a decent amount of thought, I've reduced the populace into two camps, people that buy into wealth and people that buy into health and all the things that come under that umbrella. I'd like you to comment on that.
Well, I think that's sometimes to simplify things is a good way to get a handle on things. But I think it's sad when we come to those kind of simple ways of understanding politics. And I guess one of the things I wish we'd seen more of in the debates is a little more complex analysis of the really tough problems that we face. So, for example, you could argue that by Barack Obama being concerned about health care, he was trying to control health care costs. Health care costs are the biggest problem in the state of California budget because Medicaid increases in costs really elbow aside everything else, including higher education. Corrections is the other thing that's elbowing things aside, but certainly health care costs. So Obama, by caring about that, was actually caring about wealth. On the other hand, I think people who care about wealth, they actually honestly and I think realistically and reasonably are concerned about having a country that makes sure that we really help entrepreneurs and we create jobs. And I wish there was some discussion about, it's not so simple as, well, government doesn't create jobs and business does. It's more complex than that. And we've got to come to an understanding of how, for example, I would argue the University of California is a great engine of opportunity for young people and a great driver of economic progress for the Bay Area and for the nation. And therefore, that government investment's a darn good idea. There may be some other government investments which are not such good ideas, and we should be tough-minded about that and ask government to actually perform well.
You talked a lot about polarization. Go back in history, just 30, 40 years, the Republican Party and strategists made a decision to go there for the South. And I was wondering if you analogize that to, you know, the mortgage problem. You go for as many mortgages as you can send out. It was a short-term strategy that brought in a lot of wealth, but a long-term destructive force for the Republican Party because they're now tied to it too tightly.
Well, I think so far it's worked for the Republican Party, although obviously, as usual, California is the leading indicator. And what you see in California is the strategy that the Republican Party has followed has meant they become a real minority party because increasingly they don't appeal to Hispanics, for example, or Asians in this state, and the Democrats are doing very well in those categories. There's reason to believe that's going to start happening more and more nationwide, and that's one reason I think a lot of Republicans right now think this is their last hurrah. And I really do believe that if they win the presidency, a lot of folks are going to say, if we're going to fix these problems the way we want to fix them, and they have interesting ideas and worth listening to those ideas, they will implement those ideas.
This may be a little bit of a follow-on to that. Assuming the polarization is true, which everybody agrees, looking at that diagram you had where sort of the general public or citizens, the way you described it, is to overgeneralize, in the center, what, if anything, do you think around policy, whatever, broad brush, can drive the discussion and drive the activism more to a place where there could at least be some consensus on some issues?
Well, I've actually been a proponent of trying all sorts of experiments to see what we can do in that regard. The top two primary is one approach. A lot of political scientists are skeptical of it. I understand their reasoning, but I'm willing to try on the grounds that it might drive elections more towards the center. Redistricting in the Citizens Commission, which I think did a very good job, I think created a few more competitive seats, and that's good. Part of what you need is competitive seats. Part of the problem we have now is you have seats where basically they're safe Democratic or safe Republican. If you're in a safe Democratic seat, you don't worry about whether somebody is going to outflank you on the right. You worry about them outflanking you on the left. And so you're constantly driven to the left. Same thing with the Republicans. They're constantly driven to the right because you're worried about somebody out anti-taxing you. So you better sign an anti-tax pledge. You better go along with Grover Norquist. And so that kind of thing drives people away from the center. Top two primary, redistricting might create more competition. I think the filibuster should be redesigned. We should have it the way it used to be and is in the movies, where somebody has to actually stand at a podium. Right now, if you filibuster, you can basically say, we're not going to vote on that, and we're going home. And you know, we don't care what the rest of you do, but we're just going to go home, talk to our constituents, and we're not going to stay in the chamber. There should be something that requires somebody who wants to filibuster to stay in the chamber. You got to be at a microphone. You got to get exhausted and sometimes maybe make no sense because you're so exhausted. And that's got to be on CNN. And that will start maybe changing people's minds about the kind of polarization we have. Right now, it's costless.
Yes, I haven't seen any indication from the Ryan people that these cutbacks in federal spending are going to create huge amounts of unemployment.
You haven't seen any indication that they...
From the Republicans who want to make these massive...
A realization that they could create unemployment.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem here is that in the 60s, there were a bunch of people in the Democratic Party who had crazy ideas, I think, about how societies run. And now it's a bunch of Republicans who have crazy ideas about how societies run. Not all Republicans, but there are a group of Republicans who believe in things like supply-side economics. And there was a Republican presidential candidate and actually president who described that theory correctly. It's voodoo economics. It says that if we cut taxes, and you get echoes of this, and what Ryan's talked about the cutting the tax rates, and that's going to work. And when asked, well, what exemptions are you going to get rid of so you can still get all the revenues that we currently have? They say, well, we're not so sure that, you know, but don't worry about it, it'll work. Their notion is you can cut tax rates, and people will work so much harder that the amount of revenue going back into the coffers of the government will be greater than what you had before. Now, let me just tell you what this means, and you've got to believe. You've got to believe if I cut your tax rate so that you're basically getting 1 hour of your wages back in a tax cut, that you're going to work three or four more hours. And the reason is simple. The tax rate's about 33% at the highest level. It's maybe more like 25%. And therefore, if I'm going to even get back to where I was in revenues, you've got to work 4 hours, let's say, because one quarter of 4 hours is 1 hour. And that brings the taxes back. But does anybody really believe that if I give you a tax break amounting to 1 hour of your wage, that you're going to work four more hours? I don't believe that. And by the way, the empirical evidence is that's crazy. That basically, if I cut your tax rate by 1 hour, you're going to work maybe 10 minutes more, 15 minutes more. And that'll mean there'll be some revenues that come from that, but it won't be enough to make up for the revenues lost. So it is voodoo economics. And it worries me when we have these kinds of notions running around in the political realm as if they're really solutions to problems. I'm in a public policy school. We sort of care about the facts.
Looking more into the future at this point. Are continuing to look into the future. And by the way, thank you, because I think that was a marvelous presentation in terms of all the numbers and the way you analyzed
numbers,
what
right.
you did.
I like numbers.
But there's something also regarding numbers. The one word we haven't used so far is how the younger people will continue to react to things. And when you talk about the possibility, if there is such a thing as any overlap, I hope next year, if you do come back, that you can even fit some of these things on the charts, because the direction that the country is going in terms of population would not even indicate that the future, I don't know if the Republican Party is drinking Kool-Aid at this point. Powell went officially online saying that he was going to definitely support Obama at this point. The moderate Republicans are running as fast as they can away from what has turned out to be the current Republican Party. How do you envision the possibility, even unless there is some kind of a centrist approach, is the only way I can put it at this point, to the Republican Party to make it even viable, and yet they won't let a third party really breathe because, again, we know. Look what Nader did.
Let's be clear, by the way. Both parties are agreed that the worst thing that could happen would be a third party.
Yes, and realizing
so that's both parties don't like third parties. They think a duopoly is good. They'd like a monopoly, but a duopoly is certainly better than having a third party in there. I think the Republicans, like all politicians are short-sighted. It's one reason we've gotten into some of the pension messes we're in right now. It's one reason why folks are cutting higher education, because they're not thinking about what the long-term implications are of doing that, or K-12 education. They're short-sighted. They're thinking about their next election. This has been working for Republicans. It worked for Pete Wilson when he pushed forward Prop 187, which had restrictions on immigrants to the state of California. But then, in the long run, that had an impact on Hispanics' opinion of the Republican Party in California. But he wasn't really concerned about long-term impacts. He was concerned about winning the election then. Same thing with Republicans right now. They're thinking about winning the election right now. And as long as it works for them, they're going to continue to do it. So one way you change parties, as the Democratic Party was changed in 1972, when George McGovern lost so badly, and the Democratic Party then slowly but surely came back to the center. Bill Clinton was part of that process. You got to lose, you got to be punished at the polls, and then you decide you got to change.
One thing I didn't see in your presentation that would even talk more about how this polarization is exacerbated is that when I was a kid, as the American people seemed to agree on a set of facts. We don't seem to do that anymore. It seems like each camp has their own set of facts, and nobody calls them to question on it other than PolitiFact or Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart or somebody like that. But the real, mainstream media people just seem to let both sides talk without acting as a referee. So I think that's, made the polarization.
Well, this is one
worse.
Of the problems we have is the media are very good on the one hand, on the other hand, and they often want to get in the room two people who have opposing views, because that makes for good dramatic conflict and so forth. And it's not clear how the media can call people on facts. They're just not good at that. I do think public policy schools, by the way, and the kinds of graduates we produce and the kinds of organizations we staff, like the Legislative Analyst's Office in the state of California, the Congressional Budget Office in Washington, D.C., these organizations have actually often brought facts to bear in arguments. So, for example, at one point during the healthcare debate, Obama had a plan that had to be, and these plans had to be scored, that is to say, costed out by the Congressional Budget Office. And there was a plan that simply wasn't very good and wasn't going to really work. And that essentially torpedoed the plan. I'm really happy when I see facts actually having an impact on policy. And I do think it happens. I actually think there's, in some ways, a lot of facts out there that often have a big impact on policy. But on a lot of big issues like global warming, where I think now the facts are absolutely in, A, there is global warming, B, it is caused by human beings. There was a group at Berkeley who recently did a study along these lines, starting out as skeptics and have come to the conclusion that the evidence is really overwhelming that that's so. But nevertheless, you're right, we have people who reject the facts, and that's a problem. And by the way, the left often rejects facts. The left is not doing a good job right now in facing up to the fact that pensions are a big problem in the public sector in America, and we've got to deal with that.
Yeah, so what a real effect are these super PACs and nonprofits having, particularly in the battleground states?
They're throwing in tons of money. There are some people who are beginning to wonder if there's declining marginal impact of all this money that's going in there because people are so saturated with ads. One of the interesting things political scientists are going to have to sort out after the election is how much did these ads really matter. It's hard to believe they have no impact, but they may not have as much as we sometimes think. It's also interesting to see that Obama's actually done pretty well financially in this election, although this election is just flooded with money. It's unbelievable. None of that's going to change anytime soon, by the way, because the Supreme Court is so adamant that what the Constitution says is Congress shall make no law that basically abridges freedom of speech, and that's what they're taking it to mean, and therefore corporations and other entities have the right to do these kinds of things.
Thank you for an excellent and very clear presentation. At the beginning, you showed a graph comparing the two parties in terms of people's income and education. I assume if you just looked at the Bay Area or San Francisco, it would be very different.
Well, I mean, first of all, the Bay Area is very largely Democratic. It's also true that you vary by state because sometimes in some states, rich people are more likely to be Democratic than in other states. And so there are these kinds of differences as well. I'm doing very broad averages here. What is interesting, though, is how much there is a concentration of rich people in the Republican Party, much less so, as I said, in the Democratic Party, which has a real impact on our politics.
Governor Jerry Brown, what's he doing towards overcoming the polarization?
Well, I think he's trying hard with Prop 30, actually, to come forth with a plan that I think is a pretty balanced plan. He's done a lot of cuts, and he's promising that if that doesn't pass, there'll be really big cuts, and trying to get the message out to people. The problem is, if you look at polling data, Californians believe there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse in the budget that we could actually make the cuts that are being talked about and that there will be no problem. And I ask you to look at the University of California. By the way, we educate students at the University of California at probably something like 60% of the cost of the elite privates. Okay? So we are basically producing a Cadillac product, a Stanford, Harvard, Princeton product at 60% of the cost of those entities. If you had a car company out there that was producing a Cadillac at 60% of the cost of the Cadillac Corporation of General Motors, you would say, that's a heck of an entity. That's the University of California. And we have to come to grips with the fact that further cuts are not possible for us. Now, on the other hand, by the way, cuts and corrections probably are possible. We have very expensive prisoners in the state of California. It costs us about $50,000 per prisoner in California. I have made a modest proposal in the Jonathan Swift tradition. If you remember his modest proposal, my modest proposal is to turn the University of California into a prison system. We currently get $10,000 per pupil. We'd get $50,000 per pupil. A lot of our professors are not paid as well as prison guards. They'd get better paid. And here's the best part. We have students who come and who love Berkeley or other UC campuses, and they want to stay forever. Simple way for them to do it under my plan. All they do is commit three crimes, hopefully not too heinous, and they could stay forever. So think about it. You heard this public policy idea here first, and it's the kind of imaginative thinking we need in government. Thank you.
By the way, I heard, but I can't verify, that I think Jerry Brown will be speaking to the Commonwealth Club next week because he's going around the state trying to get that proposition passed. So I think you can watch for that. He should be here next week sometime. I'm not right here, but at one of the big venues. November 1st? Okay.
Great. Quick question.
Sure.
You touched on pensions a second ago and unions versus non-unions, and obviously one party is more pro-union than the other. And, you know, perhaps unions were wonderful 100 years ago and 75 years ago to help the workers and so forth. But can you comment now on, you know, the firemen and the policemen and educators and teachers and everybody who's in a union? And it seems like it's really driving up the cost in the economy.
Before 2008, 2009, what do you think the proportion was of Republicans who voted for increased benefits, more generous pension plans for government workers in the average state in this country? Do you think it was 30%, 50%, 70%, or 80%? It's more like 70 or 80%. Republicans were as complicit as Democrats. Now, it's more like 95% for Democrats, okay? But Republicans, in a supermajority fashion, were in favor of giving these kinds of benefits to unions. The problem here, and to government workers, not just unions, because it's not clear the unions were the crucial factor here. The crucial factor here is a myopic legislature. We need mechanisms that force legislatures to think about the future. So I would suggest we need to think about things like when these kinds of long-term pension plans are put in place with more generous benefits, maybe there needs to be a referendum where the general public gets to vote on things. There needs to be ways to hold legislators accountable for decisions that have long-term consequences. So the problem is the myopia of our governmental institutions more than the fact that unions are these greedy entities. Now, it is true that unions ask for these things, but they're not the final deciders. It's the legislatures.
What about if the legislature's own pension was cut by a percentage equal to the money that was dropped, you know, not available for the pensions promised, something like that?
I don't know if that's the right thing. Actually, interestingly enough, one of the things in the budget amendment that was passed a few years ago by the state that changed the budget rule from 2/3 to 50%, it also had in there the notion that the pay of legislators would be docked for those days beyond the deadline for getting a budget done. It turns out, actually, a lot of people thought, well, that's cute, but it's not really going to have much impact. It did have an impact. So there's another mechanism. We've got to think of mechanisms that make people think more long-term. And by the way, term limits is not one of those mechanisms. It's exactly the opposite mechanism. Political scientists told folks about this. It's a bad idea. And it's a terrible idea. We don't need term limits. And I'm glad we've changed it now so that people can spend 12 years in a particular house of the state legislature, because now we'll get some people who are there long enough to understand more than where the bathroom is. They'll actually understand legislation, and they'll have a more long-term perspective because they'll know that maybe they might get judged on what they do in the long term. Right now, they're just incredibly short-sighted.
Well, we have time for one more question.
I've also been following Real Clear Politics for the last 3 weeks. But one thing I've seen is the Gallup polls tend to be on the national popular vote level, give Romney 5, 6, 7 more points than all the other polls. And that, of course, affects the poll averages.
Right.
Do you have any insight into why that's happening?
No, I don't. We call these house effects in the survey world. I ran the Survey Research Center at Berkeley for many years. And it turns out that different places, houses as we call them, have different ways of drawing their samples. They're all legitimately scientific and done correctly, but nevertheless, they often end up having biases just by the luck of the draw to some extent, or the nature of the design. And it's not always clear exactly, however, what features are that cause that to be so. And of course, we're not sure what's the right answer either here. So averaging is probably the best we can do. Another thing we can do, and people like Nate Silver, who, if you follow his blog, try to do in their statistical methods, and I do this too, is we try to look for things that look like they've been biased in one direction or another and correct for them and weight them somewhat differently. But exactly why that's so is hard to know. Polling is an imperfect business, although it's extraordinarily good, nevertheless, despite the fact we have very low response rates these days. By the way, if a pollster calls you up, answer the phone. I actually have, if you want to see, I did a video on this called Don't Hang Up, which ends with the Orlans singing, Don't Hang Up, do, 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 do. Anyway, I always wanted to be followed by the Orlans. So.
That's a great way to end. Thank you very much, Dean Brady. So, yeah, ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.